Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation.
Hey, Brad.
Hey, Justine. Did I tell you who her guest is this week? I usually do.
And I'm sure you did. I'm sure you told me, but, you know, end of the year, Christmas season, it's a little tough.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I did. It's Kristen Lepionka.
Oh, I did not hear that.
Yeah, she's on. We talk about her books, and we also talk about her podcast,
which
is a lot of fun podcast, so I would recommend that. Mm-hmm. So what do you have for us today?
Well, I have got a particularly good book this week. I know, you know, they're all good, but this one is going to get a glowing recommendation. It's that good. It's called The Quaker by Liam McIlvaney, and that's probably, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. You'll see it up on the website. It was a nominee in the 2020 Lambdas for the best books of 2019, best mystery books. It was a Washington Post best book of 2019.
Wow.
Yeah. It was issued by a imprint of HarperCollins. It's had 430 Amazon reviews. Best book you never heard of, right?
Exactly.
And it's based on true events. So glowing is what the book gets from me and apparently a lot of other people.
Yeah. You don't usually give us rating level nations in advance, so it must be good.
That's right. Well, you know, I wanted to give you, I don't want you to all go into suspense and say, gee, I wonder how this great book is going to be rated. No, it's a glowing recommendation.
Okay.
So it's based on true events. It is set in Scotland. It's called Scottish Noir. And it's I believe it's the east end of Glasgow in the 1960s. It's the same place that Jack Dixon wrote about in the 1990s. Lots of council houses, lots of gangs running there, and generally a not a good place to be at any time. And, you know, the local prison looms large in this one and was a setting for a couple of the Jack Dixon, Jazz Anderson books.
An area that's ripe for crime stories.
It is indeed ripe for crime stories. And the Quaker refers to a serial killer. The main character, D.I., which I think is Detective Inspector. I think I'm getting better at those British terms. His name is Duncan McCormick. He is gay, but he is not out and he is not partnered. So that is just sort of part of his background. He's just put away a big mobster, second in command of this local gang, and he's about to, you know, lead back up and get the head guy put away when he's called upon from his boss and the big boss to go down to another part of the area and oversee the investigation for this serial killer. The Quaker killed three women. Very brutally, you know, Jack the Ripper style. And the local police have just gotten nowhere. So he goes down and he reviews this investigation. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of witness interviews. And every lead's followed up. And they have the entire detective squad, you know, looked to me like it was about eight people working on this morning, noon, and night for months. And they resent him coming in and, you know, trying to point out what they've done wrong. And his view is the people up top are bringing him in so that there's some justification for shutting it down. The investigation has gotten nowhere. The Quaker has stopped killing. And it's really time to finish it. The detectives aren't going to solve it. It looks like the Quaker stopped killing. They haven't gotten anywhere. And the detectives pursuing the investigation don't want to shut down.
Now, is the mob a secondary arc or is it part of the, or maybe can't tell me?
Yeah, I can't tell you.
Okay. I just know you, I know you don't fuck around with the mob unless you're going to plan for trouble.
Oh, now you've got us an adult rating using that kind of language, Brad.
Oh, so yeah, there's a lot of kind of overlapping things, mostly because the mob has their fingers in everything, and there's also a big jewel heist going on, and you know, so that overlaps with the mob, that overlaps with the serial killer. It's a lot of moving pieces, and it's not the kind of thing on, you know, like some TV shows where it's like, oh, that's really a coincidence, that wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. In this kind of neighborhood, and given the way the criminal element is so pervasive and so intertwined, it is done very well and very believably.
Yeah, it sounds like different stories that all intertwine into one big one.
Right.
I like those.
He's a very good cop. And then, you know, along the way, he wants to solve it too. So he does, or at least he undertakes to sell it. And it's a relatively long book. So give yourself some time to enjoy it. Maybe set aside some time on the holiday time between Christmas and New Year's. You'll like it. You won't regret it.
And there's even time between now and Christmas.
There is, but you're going to want a good chunk of time so you can finish it. You know, it's one of those books you're going to get to, you know, halfway through, and you're going to be like, oh, got to finish it now. Even if you're not like me and need to finish everything, this is the kind of book you're going to want to, you know, crank ahead and finish it in a few days.
Okay. So glowing on that.
That's right.
Do we have anything on Weird Curtails today?
Just my usual soapbox this time of year. Get out to your local booksellers, either online or curbside pickup, and buy any of the books. We've got 3 Lev Raphael books out now, 3 of his Nick Hoffmans. We've got 3 books by Felice Bacano, and we've got several other books in print. And I know both of your books are in print, Brad.
Yes.
So support those local booksellers.
Yeah, and I have in the show notes every week, but go to requeeredtales.com if you want a list of all the books I have out. You guys have done a lot.
We've done a lot. We've done about half of them in ebook and print, and obviously all of them in ebook.
Okay, so you can check it out, and then if it's in print, get it from your local bookstore. Just order ahead.
That's it.
Okay.
Enjoy the interview, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, talk to you then. If you enjoy Gay Mystery Podcast, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. Kristen LaBianca is the author of the Roxanne Weary Mystery Series. Her debut, The Last Place You Look, won the Seamus Award for Best First PI Novel and was also nominated for Anthony and McCavity Awards. What You Want to See won Seamus and Goldie Awards. She is a co-founder of the feminist podcast Unlikable Female Characters. She lives in Columbus, Ohio, with her partner and 2 cats. Welcome to the Gay Mystery Podcast, Kristen.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you on. I'm going to start right off the bat and ask you, why crime fiction?
I mean, crime fiction is the best, right? Like, it's a genre that I've loved reading since I was probably too young to be reading it. And it's just kind of always been my favorite. That's kind of the easy answer. But I think in general, the reason that people like crime fiction so much is our world is terrifying. And when you read a story where you know who the bad guy is and you know that they're going to be put away at the end, it's like almost cathartic, right?
Yeah. The good guy wins in the end.
Yes. We love that.
Absolutely. I'm curious. You mentioned author Robert B. Parker had an influence in your writing. Mm-hmm. And I venture a guess that his most well-known novel is the Godwolf Manuscript, which is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
For those old enough to remember, the TV series Spencer for Hire was based on his novels, though I don't think they did it justice at all.
Right.
What did you learn from his novels?
Well, one thing that's great about the Spencer novels is it's one of the longest running mystery series that I can think of, even though, you know, Parker is no longer with us. The series continues. But his stories are, they're written so sort of concisely and tightly. He writes such clean, like lean and mean prose that I think that that's really something that I learned from him. The way that he can sketch out a character in like one sentence is pretty incredible. He writes extremely snappy dialogue. Plus there's just the idea of, you know, following the same characters from story to story. In, I think the Spencer series is interesting because he ages a little bit, but like not in real time. It's kind of nebulous exactly how much he ages throughout the course of the series. I think in the beginning, Spencer says that he's 38 years old, but that was like 50 years ago. So it's kind of hard to say what his age is supposed to be now. But I think like watching characters age and change over time is also something that that series is really successful at.
Yeah, it's funny with different writers. Kinsey Millhone from the Alphabet series by Sue Grafton. Mm-hmm. That whole series, I think, took place in 2 years.
Right. Yeah. She chose to like anchor that in the mid 1980s.
Which kind of makes it easy because there were no cell phones.
Yes, that's very true. Cell phones have definitely complicated things. So that is true. But I think that that's really interesting, too, because instead of like a sweeping look at a person's life over, you know, an entire adult lifetime, we're looking at a very narrow slice of Kinsey Millhone's life. She's a very busy person. Like, my goodness.
That's a lot to do in 2 years.
It sure is.
Well, I had another guest on who pointed out Nero Wolfe stayed the same age while the city of New York grew around him.
Interesting.
So everybody does it a little different, and you kind of have to play with time sometimes and just hope the reader understands.
Yeah, it's tricky, I feel like, as a writer, because when you're writing something, even if like you know that it's going to be published, it's not going to be released for a year or two. So it's very difficult to be like, if you say, okay, I want readers to be reading this book at the exact moment that it's unfolding in the fictional story, then you're basically writing in the future. So it's like time can be very tricky as a writer.
Yeah, definitely. I had a writer on recently that wanted to write in a few years in the future, and he didn't know how to include the pandemic. What are we going to be doing in a few years? Will we right. still be wearing masks? You know, so that is a tricky thing to do. Now,
yes.
One thing I find interesting, I didn't come out until I was 35. And I'm certain there's an age difference between us, but I'm intrigued because you came out as early as middle school. Would you share that experience?
Well, I came out as queer when I was 18.
Oh, okay. A little past
middle school. Yeah. And it was just sort of, you know, a thing that happened suddenly for me, I guess. It was like I would all of my sort of late middle school and high school years, I didn't really know why I didn't fit in. I just was aware that I did not. but I was also like, I had a lot on my mind. I was very busy, you know, like I was very into music when I was in school. So I was very busy with like band and choir and all these things. And I kept myself extremely busy, I think, perhaps to avoid, you know, to avoid self-reflection of any kind. And then I met someone and I was like, oh, that explains it. And it just kind of unfolded from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I can relate to that. And it's funny the changes that took place. I don't know about in your school. A couple of years ago, I was asked to speak to the Gay Straight Alliance at one of the local high schools. And I was absolutely amazed that there was such thing as a Gay Straight Alliance. That certainly never would have been in my school, especially coming from North Carolina, where right. you probably still don't mention it.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to Catholic schools for all 12 years of my formative education, I guess. So there was definitely nothing like that.
I can imagine. There were certain crime fiction writers who influenced you to become a writer, or specifically crime fiction. Now, we've talked about Robert B. Parker. What other authors encouraged you?
Well, I feel like, you know, as a writer, every single book you've read has influenced you to some extent. When I discovered the idea of like series mysteries, I really kind of started devouring those. But the very first mysteries I ever read were Mary Higgins Clark novels that my mom had in paperback on her bookshelf. And that was really the first time that I ever, you know, encountered that type of story for like written, you know, for women. I had read, you know, like middle grade young adult mysteries before that. But, you know, Mary Higgins Clark was a very influential writer. Sue Grafton, as we talked about. Then there are some queer series writers who influenced me early on too. The Sandra Scopitone, Lauren Lorano mystery series was one of the ones that I read really early. Some kind of random books that are out of print, which I always feel bad when I recommend books that are out of print. There's a book called Dry Fire by Catherine Lewis. It is not so much a mystery, but it's definitely a crime novel. It's about a young lesbian police cadet. And it's a book that I think about all the time. Definitely, you know, one of the first really positive queer characters that I had read about. So probably out of print still. It's wonderful, though, if you can get your hands on a copy of it.
Well, I'm curious, aside from that, if I just start reading queer novels, what are some novels that you say would be at the top of my list that I have to read and why?
Well, I think the Joseph Hansen, Dave Brandstetter series, of course, is one that everyone who's interested in queer crime fiction or queer mystery needs to read. Sort of like, I always kind of just loosely describe that series as like the Philip Marlowe series, except queer. The writing is like just as good, I think. And it's got that same moody California vibe to it. That's definitely one that I love. But if we're talking contemporary, I think everyone needs to be reading Cheryl Head's series, the Charlie Mack Motown Mysteries. Absolutely love those. I also really love Dharma Keller's work, the Jinx Ballou series. Mm-hmm. Those are really good ones to start too.
Yeah, I had both of them on my show. They were a lot of fun to speak with.
Nice.
So good choices. Now, Roxanne Weary is the protagonist in your four novels. Mm-hmm. Your most recent one was published in July of this year.
Yes.
Tell us about Roxy.
So Roxanne is a private investigator in Columbus, Ohio, which is where I live as well. She identifies as bisexual. She's not big into labels. She just generally goes with the label queer most of the time. She has two brothers. At the beginning of the first book in the series, her father, who was a police officer that she had a pretty complicated relationship with, he's just been shot and killed in the line of duty. And so that sort of abbreviated, troubled relationship really affects her as a person as she sort of, you know, copes with the immediate aftermath. And even now in the series, a few years later, there's still reminders at every turn where she's kind of facing that down. And relationship-wise, she has an on-again, off-again thing with a former a high school classmate of hers that they've been sort of entangled off and on for many years. And she's also involved with her father's former partner on the police force. So that's kind of an interesting relationship that she has too. But she, you know, as a person, Roxanne is very stubborn, very smart. She can be reckless. Her self-preservation instincts are not always perhaps the best. She can be reckless when she is looking for answers. And she's a little bit messed up like all of us. And she handles that by drinking too much whiskey, like many of us as well.
I can relate to that. Now, we know it's always fun to start at the beginning of a series, mm-hmm. but can each of your books be picked up as a standalone?
Yes, I would say so. I think when you start at the beginning, you have the complete picture of all of like the supporting characters, like in Roxanne's personal life and how they all fit together. But each mystery is its own self-contained sort of thing. So you can really read them in any order.
Oh, you piqued my interest because I love that.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about Once You Go This Far, which is your most recent novel. I know it's tough with a mystery, but or crime fiction, but what can you tell us about the story?
Well, I can tell you for one thing that when I wrote it, this is like that funny thing about time. I wasn't thinking that we were going to be like sort of looking at a future with a potential religious cult involved person hoping to get rid of reproductive rights. But that's sort of a thing that has unfolded in recent times. That is an element in the story, but it really begins with a woman named Rebecca, who is an experienced hiker. She's a middle-aged high school nurse, and she is out for a hike, and she winds up falling into a ravine and dying. And her daughter does not believe that it was an accident, because Rebecca was such an experienced hiker, and her daughter Maggie just doesn't think that Rebecca would have tripped and fallen, and that's that. So Maggie hires Roxanne to look into it, and it turns out that the reason that Maggie was aware of Roxanne's existence is that Roxanne was at the park when this event happened. She didn't see it, but she heard it. So Roxanne heard this woman fall, and she was like there in the aftermath and there at the hospital afterwards. So that's sort of how they connected. And Roxanne takes on this case, and she quickly discovers that there is a church that Maggie is involved in that has some very curious beliefs, some very troubling practices. And so Roxanne really winds up following, going down a rabbit hole into this group and its far-reaching, you know, tendrils, and the way that it sort of can touch everything and really make a lot of trouble for the people who are in this circle. So
I'm sure coming up with ideas for churches that are a little out there was not that difficult of a challenge.
No, sadly.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the awards you've received. And okay. I've named some before, but I don't think many of our listeners are aware of what they are, and some I'm not so sure. So you received the Seamus Award for Best First Novel. Yes. What is the Seamus Award?
So the Seamus Award is put out by the Private Eye Writers of America. It is specifically books about private investigators. So they put out Seamus Awards for Best First Novel, Best Novel, and some short story awards as well. So my the first two books in my series have won Seamus Awards from that group, which is, you know, really wonderful.
Especially the first book. That's always a surprise. Now, what about the Goldie Awards?
Yeah, the Goldies are put on by the Golden Crown Literary Society, which is a lesbian fiction, or I think it is fiction, right? Maybe it's just lesbian writers. but it's not specifically mystery, but it is specifically for the queer community. And so my second novel won in the mystery category for the Goldies as well.
Well, great job on all of those.
Thank you.
I'm going to break away from the book because this is just a curiosity question on my part. You live in Columbus, Ohio.
Yes.
And I attended my niece's wedding there a few years back. And I was really surprised at how gay friendly the city is. Not something yes. I was expecting. Is it a close-knit community for queer folks?
Yeah, I would say so. Columbus is a very queer friendly city. We have a wonderful large pride parade in, you know, the days when we were allowed to have large gatherings, unlike now. But yeah, it's a really great community. I think people are surprised sometimes that, you know, Columbus is it's a real city, even though like we're in Ohio and the rest of Ohio is probably not so friendly. The major cities in Ohio are definitely very queer positive.
Well, and Columbus has quite a few colleges and universities. Is that right?
Yes, we do have quite a few. We have Ohio State University, which is one of the biggest universities in the country. It's like number two, maybe. So we have a humongous student population, something like 40,000 students or something. Wild. It's a wild number. But yeah, I think that between OSU and some of the other, you know, smaller universities, we definitely have tons of students and young people coming from all over the place, which is really, you know, good for the culture of the city.
Yeah, I think that certainly helps, makes a big difference. So we've got to talk about your podcast.
Okay.
Unlikable Female Characters.
Yes.
And I do listen now and again, and your format's much different than this show, but it's a hoot. It's really funny.
Yeah, we have a really good time.
Yeah, it's obvious you have a really good time. Describe the show and how it came about.
So, Unlikable Female Characters, our tagline is the podcast featuring feminist thriller writers in conversation about women who don't give a damn if you like them. It is hosted by me and also my fellow bisexual crime writers, Lane Fargo and Wendy Hurd. And we came up with this podcast. It sort of happened in a roundabout way. We were kind of ranting to each other via email about, you know, something on the internet, and the conversation just sort of somehow shifted gears, and we started talking about how, you know, it would be great if there was a podcast that was all about, you know, characters that don't care how likable they are, because it's a huge thing. Just in general, if you're writing female characters, there's this expectation that they need to be likable in some way. Like, it's such nonsense. Like, because, you know, like, it's so silly to be like, oh, in order to read about this woman, she has to be like calm and kind and patient and feminine and beautiful, and she smells amazing. You know, it's just all this stuff. And we really wanted to just like play around with, you know, books that explode that trope. And when we say unlikable, we don't mean like characters that you genuinely hate. Like, we mean women who get saddled with that label of unlikable because they are complicated or difficult in some way. And you see it all the time in books. You see it all the time in real life too. Just that idea of likability being like, a woman has to be likable. If she's not likable, like, what do you do with her? Women who are powerful, smart, strong, anything like that is enough to sort of get you saddled with that label. So we just really wanted to kind of flip that on its head and really play with it. So that's kind of how that started.
So unlike Miss Marple, you deal with more characters that just don't give a fuck.
Exactly.
How long has it been running?
We started a little over 2 years ago, and it kind of like, we came up with the idea. We were like, let's give it a try. And then like, we were just so surprised when it really started resonating with a lot of people. I think sometimes when I'm, you know, at book events, I've got a little stack of stickers about the podcast that just have the logo, and people will, you know, stop and look at it and be like, unlikable female characters. And they'll just kind of think, and then they'll be like, I think I am one of those. And it's like, yeah, you're welcome. You found your tribe. So
awesome. And how often do you release a new episode?
We have new episodes out usually twice a month, every other Wednesday. We are just releasing one episode in December, just because the holidays are wild. And we actually just recorded that yesterday. But yeah, we try to do one episode per month that is an interview. Usually it's a one-on-one interview with one of us and a guest writer. And then the second episode of the month, or the other episode of the month, is a conversation among the three of us.
Well, John Copenhaver is the one that told me I need to listen to your show. And I thank him.
Love John.
Yeah, John's awesome. I began writing my first novel as a male-male romance. And it's because I thought that's all there was. Mm-hmm. And it took me forever because my heart was not in it. It just isn't my genre. Right. Fortunately, when I discovered LGBTQ mysteries, I was able to adopt that novel and take the bare bones of the story and write it. So that was no longer a romance novel. Mm-hmm. I started this podcast because I felt the need to scream, we're here, we're here.
Yes.
What do you think can be done to educate more people about the subgenre?
Oh my goodness. Well, I think we, all of us, need to be using our platforms, especially those of us who are lucky enough to be published by one of the big five publishers, to really highlight other queer crime writers, because there are so many good ones who who write for smaller indie presses, which don't get the same distribution that large publishers do. So they don't really get the same exposure, just of, you know, someone seeing the book on a bookshelf in a bookstore, you know, and that's such a huge part of discovering. But also, you know, we need to, the books that have queer characters need to be highlighted as mysteries, not just as queer books, because like there is no reason that a person of any sexual orientation cannot enjoy a queer mystery. But when you sort of shoehorn it or move it over into this corner that says this is for queer people only, it really kind of limits the reach. But at the same time, I think there are plenty of queer readers who don't even know that there are so many fantastic queer mysteries out there. We have a major awareness problem in this subgenre, I think. Like, I tell this story on my podcast. I've mentioned it several times, but like in the past when I've been trying to find a new queer crime writer to read, I'll like, you know, Google queer crime fiction. And among the first many results are articles that I personally have written. And like, I don't say that as like, oh, I'm so fancy. Like, that's annoying. I want someone else to be writing these articles. I want someone who's more famous than me to be writing them.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's like, to some extent, it's just, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to get eyes on books. It's hard for everybody. And I know that. But, you know, we really just need to highlight good storytelling and get sort of mainstream audiences to understand that these are books that they're going to love too.
And speaking on that, I looked at your books on Amazon, and if I'm correct, none of them are categorized as LGBTQ. They were all just mystery novel or female mystery novels. Am I correct on that?
I think that is correct, yes.
Well, good on you. I'm curious, in a world where so many authors self-publish, you've gone to the traditional route. And is there a reason behind that decision?
You know, no, it was just sort of how things worked out. I had written this story that I felt really happy with. And the first book in my series is actually the fifth novel that I've written. So I had written novels before. I had tried querying them with no success. And this, with The Last Place You Look, it was kind of like I'm going to give it one more try. And after that, I might look into self-publishing. Not that, you know, self-publishing is a second choice option, but being that I didn't have, you know, a good background in marketing or social media, or I just figured that someone who is a professional would do better by my books than I could myself, which is certainly true. Like, my social media is a disaster. I'm terrible at it. But, you know, when I went out querying with this book, I wound up finding an agent very quickly. And then things just kind of really went from there.
So can we expect more Roxanne Weary novels in the future?
I certainly hope so. That is a question for my publisher. Right now I'm working on a standalone mystery that's not part of the series, but I really hope that people who like the series will also enjoy this book. So I'm working on that, which that'll be out in the winter of 2022, which sounds like it could be like a million years from now at this point, but hopefully we'll all still be here.
What about another series? Any of those down the pike?
You know, I have so many ideas, so many, and it's wonderful because like we live in a time where you can write lots of different types of things. And I definitely see myself wanting to explore different types of books. Like anytime I see a heist type of movie, I'm just like, oh man, I want to write a heist novel so bad. I don't exactly know how I would do it, but like, that's definitely something that I want to do. Yeah. And I would love to write other types of characters just because, you know, writing a series is wonderful. You can sort of, you know, dip back into that voice anytime you want to. So it's, you know, it's very easy as compared to trying to write a standalone where it's like an all new voice. But at the same time, like I can see the appeal of creating another series character to do different types of work. I think, you know, right now in our current moment, writing about police is like a very loaded topic. But I think there's also perhaps room to do it in a realistic way that is fair to communities that are affected by, you know, police violence, for example. a lot of mystery novels just kind of gloss over that or almost glorify, you know, the idea of this hero cop roughing up a suspect or whatever. That's, you know, stuff that needs to go by the wayside. Absolutely. We need to stop that. So I think that, you know, at some point I might want to dip my toe into that procedural style as well.
Well, Roxanne is a private eye, correct?
Yes.
Do you get someone involved in police procedural in the process?
What do you mean? I'm not sure.
I like writing private eyes because they don't have to follow the rules.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if you have a private eye, but do you also deal with some of the rules that the police have to go through? I don't know how much there's an overlay between the two.
Well, I like writing a private eye character because of that as well. Like it wouldn't be as fun to write the types of stories that I've been writing so far if Roxanne had to follow the rules, but she is, you know, she has always been around cops. She's very sort of intimately acquainted with police and she relies on them in a lot of ways too. So she's not like a completely lone wolf. She's definitely a loner, but you know, she has to follow the rules sometimes. And it's a very different approach, I think, to storytelling, especially the idea of like, you know, a private investigator can decide what cases to investigate or not, whereas police don't have that option. So I think that's another thing that's good about writing a PI. She really has her pick of the types of cases that she works.
I've never thought of that aspect of it, but that is rather freeing. You know, my PI climbs through windows and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
It's a lot more fun to me. You kind of touched on this, but what do you think of the portrayal of women has changed over the years?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, crime fiction, sadly, is slightly behind the curve as we see kind of the sea change about the way the publishing industry deals with female characters or queer characters. If you look at the young adult age category, you have just a huge variety of gender identities and sexual orientations depicted. And I think that's amazing and wonderful. And it's like further proof that tomorrow is going to be better than today because kids who are growing up reading those books are going to expect to read adult books that are written that way too. But at the same time, mystery is like well behind that, I think. And so for a long time, women weren't portrayed well in crime fiction. Queer characters certainly were not portrayed well. There is, you know, a lot of stereotyping going on. And a lot of, especially with queer characters, using queerness to sort of denote deviance. It's a very like old practice in, you know, film and television. And that's something that like alarmingly continues to some extent. Like, you know, yes, that was something that Hitchcock movies did or novels from the 1950s did, but books now still will do that kind of thing. But I do think that there's been a wonderful boom of thrillers that are written by women in recent years that have gained a lot of popularity, which has gone a long way to sort of change that, which I love, of course. Hopefully, you know, queer thrillers and queer crime fiction will have its moment of exploding at some point too.
Kind of going on what you talked about, stereotypes. Before David Brandstetter, there was, I can't remember the author's name, but The Gay Detective, which was all stereotype.
Yes.
And I had to read it just to see. And it was funny because he used that as part of his way to solve the crime, but it was a little over the top.
Yeah, for sure. Like Pharaoh loves, you know, some of that type of just really over the top stereotypical work. And, you know, in the olden days, like queer characters either weren't represented at all or they were represented like that. And, you know, it's hard to say, was that better than nothing? I don't know. It's really hard to guess from, you know, 2020 looking back, I have no idea, but it's like queer characters should be included in stories that are not specifically about queerness. Like it doesn't need to be the defining element of any particular character. It's always ridiculous when a story of, you know, any genre has a queer character and like their function is to essentially just like be the queer person on the page. You can write a queer character who is just part of the story. It doesn't have to be a coming out story. It doesn't have to be, you know, a story that's specifically centering queerness as an element of the crime or a plot device. It can just be part of someone's character, which is, you know, that's the way that we all are. You know, we are multifaceted people and queerness is just one part of that. So in order to have, you know, books be realistic, we need to have queer characters in every book to varying degrees of importance, I guess, but it just needs to be way more common and less of like a, here's the queer character as, and more of like a, here is this person. Here are many things about them, including the fact that they identify as LGBTQ.
Yeah, I think back to the 70s, definitely the early 80s. I'm thinking of gay male movies. There was always this self-loathing that was going on. And they always had to have at least one character that was dying of AIDS. And it was, there were just tropes that they had to follow. And I'm glad we moved past that.
Yes. Well, it's just like, I'm glad we've moved past it too, but every so often, like these things still, they will still pop up, you know? And it's like, it's just so ingrained in like the culture of storytelling. I think, you know, the idea, like the idea of bury your gaze where, you know, television shows are constantly killing off LGBTQ characters. It's so true.
I watched The Walking Dead and every time they have a gay character, they're dead very quickly. Except for one guy, I think. So they killed his lover off very quickly, and his second lover off. So that's a whole different story,
right?
So that I'm glad has changed. Again, I have Christine Lepionka. I will have in the show notes some links, including to her website. And Christine, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely, thank you so much for having me. This has been a great conversation.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.